ever since I was four, I knew I wanted to be a writer. Like, that wasn't something that was a non-negotiable. I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to write fiction. That was crystal clear to me. In terms of my writing trajectory, I didn't really start including brown and Indian coded characters into my stories until high school. And I think the reason was because I grew up with stories, and I feel like this is a canon event for a lot of immigrant children, where you're like, you're surrounded by other stories that don't look like you. So you start to draw like a white person, or start to like have stories about like a white presenting person. And I think it was in high school, like, you know, as you grow older, you just become more cognizant of these things. And when I started to do my first NaNoWriMo, that's when I realized, like, wait, I have the permission to write anything that I want. I'm not exactly sure what the catalyst to that realization was. But ever since then, like, because of NaNoWriMo, I decided to write brown as fuck characters as I could. Like, you know, I just wanted us on the page for me. Like, I think what's interesting is that you'll go to like POC writers and it's like, oh, like, did you want to like represent marginalized communities, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for me, yes, that was in the back of my mind, but selfishly, I just want to see myself on the page. And if someone else could connect with that, that's beautiful. But I wrote the story for me first.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 67 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me as always is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hello, I am lovely. How are you?
Doing lovely, too. And if you want to support MJ and her work, you can pick up Among Thieves and the sequel Thick as Thieves, which are both fantastic. If you want a duology with some heists and hatchets and rogues and found family.
We needed another H, heists and hatchets and something else.
And whores, I don't know. No, it's not an H, it's a WH. But
that is
it's
a WH.
Fucking great duology, and I know you're all going to go love it, so support MJ and her work. As well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live, so check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, welcoming today's fantastic guest, Aparna Verma, debut author of The Phoenix King. Welcome to the show, Aparna. How are you today?
I am well. Thanks for having me, you guys.
Oh, that's an absolute pleasure. It's been long time coming, but I'm really, really
long time coming. Yeah,
to sit down and have
you
a proper
finally
chat.
Invited me. You know,
you finally put out a book.
Maybe that was. Right, well, I should have. You know, I should just pop them off so I have more tickets to get here on behind the scenes.
Exactly.
In the Cool Kids Club.
There you go.
That's the vibe. Just release like a ton of shit, just a deluge, and you'll be on all the podcasts all the time.
I should pull up Brandon Sanderson. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, just boom, surprise books.
Yeah. 4 in a year. Deal with it. Give me money. Okay. So to get started, for anyone who isn't familiar with you and your work, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. I am an Indian American immigrant, and my debut sci-fi fantasy novel is called The Phoenix King. It's an Indian-inspired epic fantasy set in a futuristic desert kingdom about an ex-assassin, an heir, and a tyrant struggle for power when a vengeful god reawakens and threatens to take back their kingdom. So it plays into some of the things that I really love to read and discuss, which are myths, religion, the use of religion in politics, the blurring of church and state, which I think is very applicable right now. And I just love myself a morally ambiguous characters. I had a background in journalism.
You're speaking to MJ's heart right there.
I love this because yeah. So I feel like journalists, I don't know if you guys have like journalism training, but little old Aparna thought that she would grow up to be a journalist. Then she learned they pay you like shit and they work you like a dog. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go somewhere else. But one thing that I've learned through journalism is like being as objective as possible. Of course, you can't always do that. Your biases will always enter. But I kind of have that mindset when I'm writing my characters where I don't necessarily want to judge them on the page. That's up to the readers to decide if this character is quote unquote good or evil, or if they like them or dislike them. Like, that's not my job as an author. That's the reader's job.
Yeah, I like that. That was a really good pitch. And also, I was a music journalist during university.
No way. And
yeah,
we're I also both, like, was briefly like, we're both a journalism in, major.
Yeah. So it's like we both majored in English, and it's like we did journalism.
We've all had that like, trauma.
Journalism fucking sucks. Even like music journalism, which is kind of a very niche facet of that world, still, man, it's like
it sounds very clicky, like music journalism.
I mean, yeah, in the sense that like music is a very ego-driven world.
Yes, yes.
And so it's like, oh, you're setting up an interview and blah blah blah, and people kind of have this air of arrogance about them a lot of the time, like musicians. I came from like the music world, and then compared to interviewing on podcasts in the SFF and writing world, I'm like, these people are chill. Those people, obviously it's a generalization, not everybody, but I'm like, a lot of them are just up their own fucking asses. Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh my God.
We get you.
Well, to dial it back to the book world, which is the happy place.
The happy place.
Evidently not the music journalism world. Yeah.
the writing world, not necessarily.
The writing world. Yeah.
That's true. But how did you, how did you get into reading in general and sci-fi fantasy specifically? Like, if you remember the first book or series that caught your heart?
Yeah. So I immigrated to the United States, and I have very clear, some of my clear memories is not knowing English. Like, some of my first memories is about that. And I think they're called the ESL classes, like, where like, I remember being like that kid that would be like taken out of class to take extra classes to like learn English. And the tutor was the most precious woman, like so kind hearted. And I still know her face. I've forgotten her name. I know it's like Mrs. V. And I, wherever she is, I want to bless her heart. She was the most
precious Ms. V.
Amazing. Precious Miss V, if you're listening, I still love you. And she just gave me the confidence. You know, when you're a newcomer into a new country and you don't necessarily know the language, you're the odd one out. And I felt she gave me the kindness, the patience, and the confidence to learn English. And then from there, I think I just latched onto books, specifically sci-fi, specifically fantasy, specifically Pokemon. Because as all kids do... Right? Like those,
I love it.
Those are the stories. And then Magic Treehouse books, the Boxcar Children books. It's so good. And it just was an escapism to me where I was with other characters who felt like the odd ones out. And I think I felt this kindred, like this almost like this kinship with them. And I think that's where I found belonging. It was more so on the page rather than in reality. And happy to say that I found belonging now as I've gotten older. But as a kid, I think that's why I was so gravitating towards SFF, because it felt adventurous, better than my own life. And I felt like people like me could be accepted, even though people like me weren't necessarily on the page. It's usually like white boys and white girls, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the misfits are the people who end up being like the heroes or the ones who kind of save the day.
It's a great point. That is a lot of, especially like middle grade. I mean, I think adult as well, sci-fi fantasy, but definitely middle grade. I do feel like it's always, the kid that's the odd man out. And then maybe that's why all of us became book nerds.
Yeah.
But
honestly.
Yeah. So you talked about it a little bit, that, you know, you were born in India, you grew up in the US, and I'm curious to kind of dig a little bit into how those two different cultures play into your life and how do they alter your approach to storytelling?
Yeah. So I definitely think that the two integral stories of India, specifically of Hinduism, so the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, have like really influenced my psyche in ways that I haven't quite discovered. I'm sure I'm still going to discover. But growing up, my mom refused to tell me any other bedtime story than the Ramayana. No matter how many times I would beg her, she's like, no, this is the story you need to know.
You're lucky that it's such a fucking cool story.
It's such a cool story.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I think, and it's funny because the Mahabharata is very epic and it's grand. Well, I think the Ramayana has those aspects, but it's also very intimate because of the marital relationships, the family relationships that you get to see more. I don't know. Maybe it's because that was a story I was closer to. I feel more of an intimate relationship with that, but it definitely influences the way that I see my characters, in which they have their flaws despite trying their best to be good. And goodness is also perceived, you know, like there's the tyrant king Leo who's trying to do good in his own mind that he thinks is morally correct, which isn't probably morally correct to Yasin or Alina, you know? So I think in that way, growing up with these twin cultures, it kind of influenced me. But I also think the reason I went to sci-fi fantasy rather than just like epic high fantasy is because, you know, I wanted to blend like quote unquote the East and the West. Because when it comes to sci-fi, we usually don't see brown skinned characters as the lead. So like, it's usually, they're like the wingman or something. And it made me realize just how futuristic a lot of Indian writing is and the epics, like they're flying aircrafts and missiles and bombs in the Mahabharata. Like what, mm-hmm. you know, it was already written. And so it made me reconsider of like, why can't an Indian fantasy also be sci-fi? Because we've had it ingrained in our blood already. And so I think that was a very clear and conscious decision to infuse more sci-fi elements into the book.
Yeah. Yeah. I love these influences that have kind of been brought into the Phoenix King and all that. I'm kind of curious though, like between this point and the stories mm-hmm. that you grew up with and the melding of the two cultures and the way that you kind of approached this fantasy melding with sci-fi and that kind of stuff, how did your writing journey unfold? And it's like, you told us that you went into journalism and all that kind of stuff and were very jaded, as most journalists become. how did it hit you that like, I want to write stories, and specifically like I want to write fictional stories?
I think, well, I've always been writing fictional stories. When I was 4, I would write Pokemon fanfics like that.
Dude, that's so cool.
I love it so much.
Wait. Who's your favorite character? Who's your favorite Pokemon character?
I was going to say my favorite Pokemon is Charizard. Like fire breathing dragon. Very on theme. Fire.
That's fair. Yeah.
What about human character?
Oh, I forgot. Brock.
Yes.
Was that like one of the original? He's so good.
Brock is such a well-written character because he's such a dick. When he just like swoons over every woman, he's just like, you have tits and I'm just going to like fawn over you like crazy. But he's just such a good comic relief, man. He was so good.
Okay. He kind of reminds me of Michael from The Office.
Yeah.
That you know that's an idiot. But yeah. he's a well-meaning
lovable,
idiot. You know?
Lovable, well-meaning.
A lovable idiot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every cast needs one, to be honest.
They do.
Oh, man. Okay, so after Pokemon fanfic, what was next?
I don't know. I feel like ever since I was 4, I knew I wanted to be a writer. Like that wasn't something that was a non-negotiable. I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to write fiction. That was crystal clear to me. In terms of my writing trajectory, I didn't really start including brown and Indian coded characters into my stories until high school. And I think the reason was because I grew up with stories, and I feel like this is a canon event for a lot of immigrant children, where you're like, you're surrounded by other stories that don't look like you. So you start to draw like a white person, or start to like have stories about like a white presenting person. And I think it was in high school, like, you know, as you grow older, you just become more cognizant of these things. And when I started to do my first NaNoWriMo, that's when I realized, like, wait, I have the permission to write anything that I want. I'm not exactly sure what the catalyst to that realization was. But ever since then, like, because of NaNoWriMo, I decided to write brown as fuck characters as I could. Like, you know, I just wanted us on the page for me. Like, I think what's interesting is that you'll go to, like, POC writers, and it's like, oh, like, did you want to, like, represent marginalized communities, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for me, yes, that was in the back of my mind, but selfishly, I just want to see myself on the page. And if someone else could connect with that, that's beautiful. But I wrote the story for me first, you know?
Yeah, I feel like that's what makes it so genuine. And that is, that's, I'm sure, why it connects with so many people, because it is so genuine. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love exactly.
That. Yeah. So I'm curious, let's dive into a little bit more specifically The Boy with Fire, now published mm-hmm. as The Phoenix King.
Can I grab the copy? I have here.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Let me get like the original version. I have it here.
Ooh, I love it.
So you can see, here's the mind fuck. Like, just see how like different and like how
yes,
the thickness has changed so much. Like, the Phoenix King is 30,000 words longer and stronger, I think.
That's amazing. Damn. I'm loving Orbit for encouraging the longer word counts, because yeah. I feel yes. like a lot of times publishers want authors to cut. And
yep.
Yeah, we talked to we want more.
Yeah, like, we talked to Alex Darwin about that exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Same experience with.
Did they make him cut
adaptation? With
no. They asked him to add.
They had him beef it out.
Yeah. Yeah, the same thing happened to Nick Eames as well. They asked him to like add more to his manuscript.
And that's Orbit too. Yeah. Okay, so Orbit is just a fan of the chonkers.
Thank you, Orbit. Love it. Thank you.
I know, right? Oh my gosh. But yes, okay, so The Boy with Fire and now The Phoenix King. Where did the idea originally come from? Like, how did it burst into being for you?
Yeah, so The Boy with Fire, I had that story idea for, I think, 13 plus years ago. I have the date. It was March 26th. I don't remember the year, but I have the date because now that's Yasin's birthday. Like, it's his birthday now.
Nice.
Oh my God, I love that. Because it's literally 26th. His birthday. Yeah.
I don't know what his sign would be, but that's what he is. And
March 26th, he's an Aries.
He's an Aries. Okay, so maybe that fits his character. I don't know.
Yeah. A little witchy.
I like that. It started off with one line, and this is maybe like the childhood part of me where I was like, I wanted a name that rhymed with the person's occupation. So he was an assassin. So what's a name that rhymes with assassin? Yasin. And what organization is he from? The Ar-O-Hasin. So Yasin, the assassin of the Ar-O-Hasin, goes on an adventure and meets his match in Alina. That was the first line. And so I think people are surprised that Yasin was the first character that came to me as opposed to Alina. And I think in a way, I think why I gravitated towards Yasin is because, so in the stories, he's mixed race, in that he's a mix of like Ravani and Janthari, which is coded for Indian and white. But he's white presenting, like he's white passing. I have family members who are white passing. I have friends and relatives. And I realize there's a stigma around mixed race individuals that I personally have seen in the South Asian community. The Juggernaut, which is a South Asian magazine, just did an amazing article that I highly recommend people to read about this stigma. And they just, like, this week they covered it. And I think I really gravitated towards that because being Indian American, I felt like I was always living within the hyphen of that identity, where didn't feel Indian enough for the Indian kids, didn't feel American enough for the American kids, which is, again, a very, I think, prominent sentiment in immigrant children, and especially first generation. Like, I was born in India and I came here. And I felt this just familiarity with Yasin because he also didn't fit in. Alina knows who she is. So she was almost like an aspiration. Like, you know, she knew who she was. She owned it. And she believed strongly in her ethics and her values. And that to me felt integral of someone who I wanted to be later on. So that's how the first two came together. Years went by, and then Leo's, her father's character, came into play. And I named him after my sign because I'm a Leo too. And he's a fire sign. He's very, he's very much a Leo. And I had to have that in the book. So
amazing.
We're getting all astrological up in here. I love it.
We are.
I know. We
are.
We don't do it often enough, man.
Okay. Speaking of fire.
Yes.
Aparna, why do you love fire so much? I know you love Charizard. He's your favorite Pokemon. Like, yeah. What do you personally love about fire?
So here's the thing. I'm a Leo, so it's a fire sign. Let's start with that. Okay. Maybe there's a natural affinity there. I think people have this misconception of fire, of it being wildly destructive. But I remember, I think this was maybe when I was in middle school and we learned about ecology. And I remember the teacher was telling us how fire was necessary for regrowth and rebirth. Because when a fire consumes the undergrowth of a forest, it allows newer plants to come through and it actually gets rid of decaying things that kind of hold the forest back in a way. And that has always stuck with me, of how fire has this duality of being both destructive and nurturing. And to me, that's, for as a writer, that's what interests me, is that duality. It's that this almost like moral grayness of fire itself. And I think that, I don't know, I feel like that aspect,
the most morally gray element,
character.
I love it.
Yeah, it's fire. I mean, the Fire Nation was the coolest nation. Come on.
Oh,
like,
hell yeah. An Avatar?
Avatar Last Airbender. Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you were a firebender as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess so. I don't know if there's like a BuzzFeed quiz for it, but I'm sure I will be in the fire.
Which nation are you?
Yeah, so there's a BuzzFeed quiz for like, what kind of bread are you? I'm sure there's one for that.
Yeah.
Or for like, what nation are you from? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that though, because like fire, yeah, it's so cool to see, because it's like now living in Ecuador and seeing how things go in the Amazon and the mm-hmm. sort of cycles of nature there, but also growing up in British Columbia. In Canada, yeah. and the ways in which fire is such a present part of life for so many
yeah.
people now. And has always been like an integral part of the forest, and to see the forest and kind of understand, like you were talking about, the ecological cycles of destruction and regeneration. And that to me is just like so beautiful, to be able to like encapsulate such an incredibly powerful metaphor within these natural
yeah.
processes.
And you know, another thing that just made me think of, I've always, fire is also very present in Hinduism. So the Saat Phere, which is the seven like rounds around the fire when you get married. I am a romantic at heart. I have always dreamed of having a big Indian wedding and taking those Saat Phere. And I have always, I don't know, like, as a kid, I just found that so beautiful, of how this relationship is melded around a fire and your family and friends are bearing witness and they're throwing flower petals at you. And there was something so magical in our own reality that existed. Like, it just felt like real magic. And ever since then, I don't know, it just seems natural for me to be gravitated towards that.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
That is beautiful. That is beautiful. So for the book, let's talk publishing path a little bit, because we yeah. talk with all kinds of writers that do all kinds of different paths. I'd love to just hear about what those paths look like and how they feel for people and why they do the things they do. So why did you originally decide to go the self-publishing path with mm-hmm. The Boy with Fire? And then how was that whole aspect of your journey? Like, how did that go for you?
Yeah, so... The Boy with Fire had been like It was like very bad NaNoWriMo drafts that I just tried to rework again and again. And it wasn't until March 2020 when the world shut down and, you know, you were like, for me, like I was forced to stay in, you know, I was inside, like I couldn't leave. There was nothing else to do. And I thought, you know, might as well write the book at this point of time. I also think there was so much darkness in the world, specifically amongst our leaders, the way that they handle the COVID situation. But also, I've just been seeing more of this nationalistic movement across so many different nations, India, the UK, America, like just around the world. And that to me was concerning. And I think it had been bottling up like just throughout the years, and the pandemic came and suddenly I had this time. So I started to write the book, and I just remember it being a fever dream because I drafted it in 4 months. I've never drafted something that fast before. Granted, I took the next year and a half, 2 years to keep revising it before I published it. But I had finished the book, and the more I started to learn about traditional publishing, the more I realized it's not a meritocracy. And it's not geared for people of color. It's just not meant to serve us, as most systems. And so with so many gatekeepers in the way of my book being published, I decided to take it into my own hands of self-publishing. And I ran an Indiegogo, which is kind of like a Kickstarter GoFundMe, where I went through all my friends in my Facebook list and just DM them. I had no shame. I'm just like, hey, I'm writing
amazing.
A book.
Like, yeah. The worst they could do is ignore the message, right? So who cares? Yeah,
exactly. Or say no. Exactly. And so the goal was 5,000. I think we raised a little over 7,000, and it usually takes about 5,000 to 6,000 to publish, to indie publish one book. And so I did the ebook and a print. I didn't have enough money or the time or resources to do audio. And I decided to take a bet on myself where I told myself, I'll give myself a year. And if the book does well, great. You know, that's awesome. And if it doesn't, then I would have learned something. Like I would have learned a little bit more about the industry. I think I would have learned a little bit more about how to fend for myself, how to know my worth. Being the eldest immigrant daughter, I'm used to doing things on my own. I think I also went to Stanford, which is it's a heart of Silicon Valley. It's very entrepreneurial spirit. And I think that kind of got into me. And so I just took a bet. And the book was set to come out in August 2021. I lost my job, I think, in April 2021. Luckily, I was living with my parents during the pandemic. And they knew this book was coming out, and they said, you know, keep searching for a job, but they didn't put pressure. And sometimes Indian parents can be very, like, put a lot of pressure on you to keep performing, especially as the eldest, you know, child. And so they gave me the grace of, and I think this is a very privileged thing for me to be able to do, was like, okay, I had money saved, and they said, I don't have to pay for groceries, I don't have to pay for rent. We'll give you this time to look for a job and promote your book. So from May until August, I went full into TikTok. I was against TikTok for the longest time. I thought it was dancing teenagers, you know? Yeah. And it is in a way. It was,
yeah,
my younger
there's a
brother.
Corner of it, I'm sure. I don't
there's
think
a corner.
That anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. And my sibling, my youngest brother, he was the one who told me about it. And he was like, you got to get on. Like, people are talking about books on there. And I was like, there's no way. And so I spent a whole month in April just researching. Like, I didn't even post. I just researched what was being posted on BookTok, who were the biggest players, who were the biggest authors, and who was doing it well. And just like understanding trends, understanding keywords. I started to shift into marketing jobs, and that really helped me as well. Just like knowing how to play the system, and, you know, like knowing how to market something. And so luckily it worked. Like it went pretty viral. Like it was the first, The Boy with Fire is the first South Asian adult fantasy to hit over 1 million views on TikTok. It was featured on NBC News, on the Stanford Daily, a local Fox News network in Florida. And so it was getting media coverage. And that's when Orbit started to pay, Orbit kind of got wind of it. And then I started that transition to trad.
Dude, that's so cool though. Like I love how, I mean, props to your parents for giving you the time and the sort of like foundation to build off of and get that done.
Yeah. And it's the sweetest thing, is like, so my dad, I'm not from a wealthy family. Like we were immigrants. Like we were like very low. We were, poor. My parents, like very, very low middle class, lower class. And my dad's an Uber driver. He's been an Uber driver for maybe 8+ years now. Not a lot of money in that. But he would tell his Uber customers about my book. Fuck, and he was so proud about it. It's funny. Maybe it comes apart like in Leo and Alina's relationship. Yeah. But my dad and I, we don't physically show, like, visibly show each other love. Like he won't really say like, I love you. But he'll show it in like the little ways. And that was
the meaningful gestures.
Yeah. The meaningful gestures. Yeah. He would call up his friends. He's like, my daughter just wrote a book. You should pre-order it. And it was amazing. Yeah.
Props to your parents.
They were very happy.
Incredible.
They're very sweet.
So it's like you starting with TikTok as sort of this way of like pushing your book into more people's sort of spheres and attention. And you mentioned that Orbit got wind of it. Can you tell us a bit more about how The Boy Against Fire got picked up by Orbit and what that transition from self-pub to traditional has been like for you?
So it happened because of Twitter, not TikTok, but I think people from TikTok, as always, book Twitter and book talk are very closely. Yeah. So much crossover. Mm-hmm. And the group fan art of like the cast of the characters, I think the marketing director at Orbit saw it on Twitter and he said it to Priyanka, my editor. And he said, you need to look into this. Like this seems right up your alley. And so when I got into contact with Orbit, Priyanka was already reading the book. So that was really cool. Like I decided, again, the go-getter attitude. I saw Brie, who is one of the senior editors at Orbit. She made a tweet about like wanting Southeast Asian fantasy. And I asked her like, what about South Asian fantasy? She's like, yeah, like I would love it. So I was like, should I? Will I? I was like, I'm just going to do it. I emailed her and I told her like, it's this book I self-published and it's doing so well. And she emails me back saying, you should talk to Priyanka because I think she's reading this right now. And I was like, what do you mean? And so I emailed Priyanka and Priyanka's like, yeah, I'm in the middle. Like I'll email you back over the weekend, during that weekend, I was like stressed. I was like,
oh yeah. You're like refreshing your email like every 4 seconds.
Yeah. I was like, is she going to love me? Like what's going to happen? And I remember getting this email from her saying, I'm reading it right now. And it feels, I got to find the email. But she was like, it feels so familiar to me in like in terms of the characters and the world, and I love Alina and I want to like, I love Yasin, but I want to shake him by the shoulders and give him the hug at the same time. And I thought to myself, is that a good reaction? Is that good? And I asked other authors, they're like, that's a good reaction.
That's a good reaction. Yeah.
That's a good reaction. And Priyanka kind of was like wink wink, like, hey, you should get an agent, just saying. And so I reached out to Lucienne Diver, who's my agent now, and like she was not taking any submissions, but a friend of mine was already agented with her, and so she took only solicited, so she put me in contact, and I very clearly put in the subject line, Orbit editor interested.
Get to the top of that slush pile. Heck
no,
I mean
it's like the TikTok like keywords, just knowing how to work that shit, be like, right? This will get your attention. Just
exactly. And so I sent it to her on Friday. She started reading over the weekend. On Monday, she sends me an email saying, I'm 60% through, but I want to sign you. Like, this is amazing. So we jump on a call that week and she was like, she gave me her pitch. She's like, I don't know what to say other than like, I really want you. Like, tell me what I, and she just made it very clear. And I, it just, I signed with her because Lucianne had a lot of South Asian women on her client list, which to me was a very big thing. And I believe in little signs. She was also from Baltimore, and I grew up in Baltimore. So that was like a little
cool.
I was like, maybe this is meant to be.
Like a link to the universe. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so I signed, and she's amazing. I love Lucianne. She's like, she's a baller, like, you know. And since then, like, we got the deal with Orbit a few months later, and just been off to the races since.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that.
Right? I was going to say, congrats. That's amazing. It sounds like things have moved so quickly through, you know what I mean? Especially compared to a lot of publishing, which is awesome.
Yes.
I'm curious if you could kind of give some of your takeaways from each publishing path and kind of like contrast the two journeys, which, I mean, may be difficult actually for you hearing how quickly things moved between the two. It kind of maybe is a little blurred, but.
Yeah, I feel like I was just dipping my toe into indie publishing when I got picked up by Orbit. And so one thing right off the bat, I went to my first Worldcon in DC, I think in 2021. Or was it 2022? No, it was 2021. And the nicest people were the indie authors. Like right away, like they welcomed me. We got food together. We would walk back to the hotel rooms together. You know, like it was just like really this camaraderie, like right away. And it made me realize a lot of indie publishing are people helping each other. Like people talk, like, and it's not so much the same in traditional. In that traditional, when people talk, it's more so like through whisper networks. Like people don't say things like clearly. Out loud, yeah.
Versus indie, industry for sure.
Exactly, and I think for indie, like it's like no, like here's how I do Amazon ads, like here's like the rhyme and reason to this, and I will tell them about TikTok, and they're like, can I hire you? I'm like, please, like I'm barely doing it able, like for my own self, and so, but yeah, it was like the best crowd, and I have so much respect for indie authors because it's really a business, like people. Don't realize like each indie author is their own business because to grind out those books and some of them are making like six figures a month, like they know what they're doing and they just keep churning out books and they know what their fans want and their fans keep loving it. And they may not have the fame and acclaim as traditional authors do, but they're probably making more money. You know,
so to say people I know that are full-time authors are on the indie pub side.
And the thing is like, people. There's a difference between fame on a broader scale, but you know, fame with your readership. And I think like the readership thing is huge, and to have like a very dedicated audience. Like I've talked to our mutual friend Ryan Cahill about this, and he's like,
yes,
he is so fucking good with his readership and his community.
Ryan's amazing.
It's like a master class.
Yeah, like establishing a really good rapport with them and talking with them and interacting with them in ways that for them, I guarantee feels so meaningful. And it's like to have that relationship with the readers for a lot of authors is like, that means way more than, you know,
it's a lot of work
award or being a bestseller, like on whatever list and that kind of thing. And yeah, it is 100%. Like you have to be entrepreneurial and you have to work your ass off, but it's like the work is worth it, man. For a lot of
it's people. Worth it. Ryan was the one who convinced me to make a Discord group for the book. So I like once a book comes out, I'm like, here's a link, everyone. Like, and you know, and
come talk to me, talk spoilers, talk whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, exactly.
So good. And you showed us earlier the two copies, like the version of The Boy with Fire versus The Phoenix King. You added 30,000 words, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Also, really. Just really cool. I can imagine like for you to be able to say like, I had the story and I'm really proud of it, but I also get to give you more. So for you, what kinds of things were you able to add to the book? And how did those changes improve the story through whatever you were able to add, but also through the editing process of being able to work with the editors at Orbit?
One thing that my editor made clear to me, it was like, she wanted a lot more world building. You know, she's like, I just want to learn more about this world.
That was the same with Alex. That was the same with Alex with the combat codes. Yeah.
They just want to learn more. I was like, heck yeah, world building is my favorite thing to do.
That's the fun part, of course.
That's the fun part. Characters, if they misbehave, they're hard. But they wanted to do more world building. And so here's the funny thing. I had a reader message me. So at the beginning of each chapter, there's like a little quote from a text within the world, within the context of the world. And epigraphs. And they said, the reader said, I literally Googled these texts thinking that they were real things. Like, I didn't realize.
Nice.
Right? You made me stuff. And I was like,
I made a book within my book.
Yeah. And so I was like, I have documents about the great history of Seon, the Princess Nomu's diaries. Like, I have it all in separate documents. Maybe if the book does really well, I could publish those little things. That was like some of the things that they were looking for, like getting deeper into the rich history of the world, which I was very happy to give. But I think another thing that made this a lot stronger was, I think I went a lot deeper into Alina's character and her character development. It was strong in the beginning too, but I think I added an extra layer, which I felt gave her more agency and gave her a bit more independence out of the shadow of her father. In The Boy with Fire, she was very much like a one goal woman, learning how to wield fire so she could walk the Ugnipath and take the throne and be, crowned as a Phoenix King. In the revised version, that's also her goal, but another thing that she does is undermining her father's influence and undoing everything that he's done cruelly to their kingdom. So there's this group of nationalists called the Gold Caps. They were once called the Red Caps, and my past editor, was like, "That's a little too close to the Trump supporters." I was like, "You're right. Let's change the color to Gold Caps."
There we go.
And the idea for me was when I saw the rise of just really, it was usually like hardcore male leaders who have a nationalistic bent. What interests me is not the leader, but the people who are supporting them. Because without their support, that leader would be nothing, right? It's like without your supporters, you can be nowhere. And so it was really interesting to me in the revised version to start to investigate some of these Gold Caps. And Junjir, who is their leader, is kind of like a kiss ass to Leo, but he has his own conniving plots. And seeing Alina interact with him and his secondhand Varun, it felt richer to me and just more interesting as the storyteller was like, oh, I can go deeper here.
Mm. Well, that's speaking of digging deeper.
It's a good segue.
Segue.
A little bit deeper. Yes, thank you. I crushed it. No, into the Phoenix King. So there's two big things that we want to discuss. And I know that you've touched a little bit about characters so far, but the book has just such a well-rounded cast of deeply flawed, captivating, wonderful characters. How do you approach writing characters? Like, what does your character building process look like?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned earlier, like, I like to have a more journalistic approach to writing these characters in that where I try to be as objectively fair in showing the both that, their good sides and quote unquote their bad sides. And letting the reader be the judge. And I know there's like more of a trend to be like morally gray and morally ambiguous, but I feel like that's always been human history.
Well, that's just what people are like. I feel like if you're the hero in your story, you're the villain in somebody's, Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And we've always heard you're always a hero of your own narrative. And so for me, what compelled me about these characters was showing how much they love each other and how much they fuck it up in the name of love, I think because that's a very human thing. Like, I think sometimes love drives us to be overprotective. Sometimes love drives us to seek validation. Sometimes love drives us to keep secrets. And I wanted to explore that with each of these characters. There are moments when I'm writing a Leo chapter and I'm like, this is almost symbolic of Yasin too. You know, like some of the things that he does, and I can see like the spider webs, like where they connect, like the different beats. And I was like, this is what made me so happy with the finished product, was like how you can see they're kind of similar. They're very distinct, but they have similarities where if they sat down in a therapy session, maybe they'd find out.
They could find some common ground.
But it's even the same with like Alina. It's like she shares a lot with her father, but also with Yasin and the different characters. Is like there's a lot of crossover where even us as just like regular human beings living our day to day, it's like we connect with other people through our similarities, but we also clash with each other in a lot of different ways based on you know, our own individual preferences, our own individual personalities and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. One of the other things that I wanted to explore was this idea of like generational trauma and like the burden of the father. So in the Phoenix King, there is the heir gets chosen once they're like, they reach 25 sons, which means like 25 years of age. And they have to take on the burden of the throne, but the burden of the throne comes with something else, which I will not say because of spoilers. and it makes it suddenly very real about the job title, like the job description. Like they think like, oh, like I'll be the Phoenix King, like I'll rule this like desert kingdom. But no, there's so much more that goes into being that ruler. And I wanted to explore how families kind of, not just like as kings and queens, but how families pass down this generational trauma, where Leo, like you said, Alina's similar to Leo in ways that are very scary and not good. And she starts to realize some of these similarities like later on in the book. But you see the burdens of like what he had to carry slowly seep into her. And I think there's this big moment for Alina is when she starts to realize that and realize what exactly it means to be the Phoenix King and later to be the Burning Queen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about tropes too.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I said, I'm a big fan of the enemies to lovers trope.
One trope that you love. Don't you?
I love a lot of tropes. Let's be real. Wait, which one are you thinking of?
No. I'm saying Aparna loves a particular trope.
Oh, Aparna.
Trope.
I was like, wait,
oh, yeah.
I know what
wasn't
tropes,
aware.
I know what tropes you love.
I wasn't aware. I was on record with favorite tropes. But yes. I'm curious, why do you love the enemies to lovers trope? And how are you able to play with that in the story?
So funny story. I did not know what tropes were before TikTok. Like when I was writing
you all about tropes,
right? Because journalism, like in journalism, tropes are like integral to, you want to tell a story in a certain way that is going to convey the information that the reader needs. You write that in a tropey ass fucking way so that people are aware of the format and know what you want to say. And then it's like
exactly
fiction. And people are just like, I hate it. I love it. Fuck you. Blah, blah,
right.
Blah.
Yeah. Right. And it's just kind of like when you're just delivering the news, like you're not like, there's no feelings involved, you know, like you're just like going straight for it. But when I started writing The Boy with Fire and I got on a book talk, I was like, yeah, I think my book has this trope. It has enemies to lovers. Like, yeah, it has slow burn. Does it have a one bed scene? I don't know. You know, like it was almost like I was working backwards. Where like I already had the book written and I went to book talk and I was like, okay, how do I market this thing? And I started to see it. And now I have like more affinity because now I know what enemies to lovers really is. But I think one of the things that I love about this trope is that, or enemies to friends, enemies to lovers, is how at their worst, there's almost this mutual respect and understanding where, like, you could have, you know, betrayed this other person, you could have murdered their family, you could have done awful, awful things, but there's always this recognition of them as your equal because you are so both so terrible in your ways. And I think for any relationship that does have love in it, there needs to be mutual respect. There needs to be mutual equality. Like, there needs to be equality and an equal standing, or else that relationship is not going to last. If one person's always overpowering the other, it's going to be, you know, possessive or overpowering. And so I think that the reason I gravitate towards that is because I feel like it just feels so human to know each other at your own worst. I think some of the couples who in my life, like the older couples or stories in which, like, I've gravitated or in movies, I love seeing, you know, the conflict between these either married couples or this people who are dating, and seeing how they come from that stronger, because I'm an idealist. Like, I believe in love, and knowing that they accept that darker part of themselves. I think, like, acceptance, I don't know, being an immigrant kid, I've always wanted to be accepted for who I am. Maybe, like, they're in some way enemies to lovers, there is that inherent acceptance of who you are.
Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, like you're saying, in order for a relationship to truly, like, thrive and grow in mm-hmm. that mutual acceptance, is like, you need to understand that other person's darkness as much as yes. you need to understand their beauty. And the majority of relationships that end because someone is unable to accept the darkness of the person that they're with. The, yes. the beauty of the person is like the veneer that gets the relationship started. And then you start right. to dig deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. Once you get to that darkness and you're just like, oh, fuck no. Or
yeah.
alternatively, you could be like, you know, intrigued, but also more enamored with that person based on the way that they're able to handle their darkness, or the way that they're able to surpass certain things despite the shit that they've dealt mm-hmm. with in life. So it's like, yeah, yeah. I totally feel you. I really,
yeah,
really like that. And it feels really
human. I think we found Adrian's favorite trope.
Yeah. Enemies to
lovers. I'm all about enemies to lovers. Actually, no, in my debut, I do have, like, not necessarily like an enemies to friends, but it's more sort of like a dislike to friends kind of
rivals so. To friends.
I was just going to say rivals not to even, friends. Yep.
Not even rivals to friends. It's more like someone who's very discriminatory and racist learning to accept and embrace someone as a close confidant kind of thing. So, yeah,
I
but
like
enough
that.
About me. You mentioned world building earlier, and I want to dig into that a little bit more. So you're able to add 30,000 words to this book through Orbit, and a lot of that was world building. I love the epigraphs, and I love how you're able to flesh all that stuff out with all the different factions and the nations and everything that went into that. For you to be able to, like, build out this world, you say that you have, like, the epigraphs and documents, and you have all this stuff written out and stuff like that. How did you balance all of that world building that you were doing with that aspect that you mentioned earlier of taking the more science fantasy elements of Indian mythology and Indian stories, and just kind of like finding that right balance between sci-fi and technology and fantasy elements like magic, like very explicitly, like there's fucking fire magic in this book. Like, how
yeah.
did you
yeah, there's fire bending, nice guys. Like,
yeah. hell yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I think it came really naturally because the way my perspective was, I think of, like, in, like, you know, cities in India, I think of New Delhi or an old Delhi. And I think of how, you know, you have these monuments, these ancient monuments and these ancient, like, historical sites right next to someone who's, like, talking on their cell phone, you know, or someone taking a selfie in front of it. Or you're seeing, like, these old rickshaws, you're still seeing, like, you know, older means of transportation. And then you're seeing like high-tech cars, like, you know, imported cars, Mercedes and whatnot. And
like straight up, like I was in Jaipur and I saw someone riding an elephant and I'm like, damn, dude, like.
Oh, they're so great. I've always wanted to ride one and I chickened out, but I did get the elephant's blessing, the hathi's blessing. So that made me happy.
Love it.
Yes. But like you like, right. Like you're seeing, you know, this more so ancient past and the culture coming in hand with modernity. And there's this one description of like marching modernity early on in I think it was like either Alina's chapter in her first chapter, where we start to learn about Rani, the capital city. And you see that incongruity, like, you know, of like, you see these ancient step walls, but you also, and the chhatris, but you also see hover cars, you know, and she's like carrying a holopod and like looking through reports. And it just became so natural because that's how our world is like. Just fast forward a few years, you know, our religions are centuries, thousands and thousands of years old, and we still hang on to them as we have cell phones, as we have AI. Right. So it just seemed like it would be anti-human to just go straight into sci-fi bent without having any of that religion or quote unquote magic, because we've been doing that for eons. Like, why wouldn't that be in our books? Hello, Kitty.
Sorry, we have a visitor.
I love that.
Our resident.
She's interested in the story. She's like, I want to go to Ronnie.
Yeah, but I love that. And that's why, you know, I love the blend of science fiction and fantasy, where it's like books like Dune really resonate with people. And mm-hmm. you know, new generations are able to be introduced to it through like the new movies and stuff like that. But this blend of science fiction and fantasy really speaks to the various facets of what makes us human. It's like we are ancient beings in the sense of our cultures and our societies and our traditions, but we are also wrapped up in the new and the hot shit like cell phones or like TikTok and whatever. And that's why you have like this weird dichotomy of like you go onto to social media and you see someone who's like deeply into mythology, and then on the other hand you have someone who's just like fucking twerking, and it's just this weird like
humans. You'll get that both on your For You page on TikTok.
We contain multitudes, all right?
Of course. Twerking and mythology. That's my gender.
Twerking and mythology. Yeah.
If only I could see the
brought to you by TikTok
goddesses twerking, that would just be my dream come true.
I'm trying to fix the light because it's starting to get darker here.
No worries.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's okay.
Always a challenge. It looks great. Yeah. I feel like you've hinted a little bit with some of the world building stuff that you have, that you're like, well, you know, if there's audience, maybe we could release some of this stuff. But I'm just curious how you're planning on expanding upon the Phoenix King in the rest of the trilogy. And then also, what else are you working on? Do you have any other plans to expand beyond the trilogy or totally new project?
Well, book two is in the works. The deadline is end of August. So I am racing to it. The titles for book two and book three have been finalized though. We're working on the cover of book two. So that's like really exciting for me to look forward to. It's like, okay, I got to write faster because like that they're already starting. So there's a trilogy. Hopefully it's three books and not four books. There's hopefully it stays within three books and I don't pull like a Red Rising and I have to write like a whole next trilogy for it. Yeah. A sequel trilogy. I do have other like works. I really want to do, and I've talked to my agent about it, and she loves the idea of like an Indian mythical retelling. Like I've always been drawn to mythical retellings, but we barely see Indian myths being retold. And there's this one that I really, really love, and near dear to my heart. And it's book two is very dark and depressing. And this side project gives me hope, you know?
It's like your ray of light right now.
it's my ray of light. And creative contrast. I'll go to that. I have this other story, and I've hinted about it before, and I'm in the midst of researching because I feel like it's one of those stories where I feel like I feel inept as a writer. Like, it feels too big for me, you know? Like, you ever have those ideas? You're like,
I have projects where I'm like, that's like my 10 years away project.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, as I mature.
I have them too, where I'm like, I'm going to wait on this one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So he's stepping on my keyboard.
No, oh, they always do. They just love the clickety clacks of the keyboard. yeah, but it's like a futuristic steampunk British Indian Revolution era book involves the heist of a very infamous diamond.
I am fucking sold.
I was gonna say so you were, I was in from the beginning. I am aggressively in now.
Yeah.
Yay, good. Well, I'm like researching, and I'm working with this amazing PhD candidate in Toronto, actually. And she gave me this long list of reading material, and it was amazing. And I was like, thank you so much. This is why we need researchers and PhD students, and like support them, please. And so like, I've been like just trying to do my reading and my homework in between writing. And so there's always too many ideas. And too little time, you know.
So true.
That sounds amazing, though. Also, to all of the writers out there, do not be afraid to look up an academic's email and email them if you need help with research. Because I found that a lot of them are fully willing to, like, I straight up just like reached out to a mycologist in Wisconsin while researching my book, and he was like, yeah. I'm down, like, tell me about it.
I love it. Then, you know, it's probably like a super cool thing for them, because it's like the thing they nerd about the hardest. Someone is asking them about their passion. Oh my god. Of course. I mean, exactly. I'm sure not all of them want to talk about it, but
a lot of them
probably
do.
A lot of them do.
All right, well, Aparna, to close out, I've got two requests. First, can you give listeners and viewers a good bit of soundbite writing advice? And the next is to tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating.
Ooh, okay. A writing advice I would say is lead with curiosity. I think we're all natural storytellers. Some are just more attuned to it than others. And the way you attune that natural gift that you already have, you have to start nurturing it. So start to listen. Because your heart will tell you, like, you will know if there's a certain moment in your life that speaks to you, it's because the storyteller within you is gravitating and is trying to create a narrative around it. So pay attention. Just, you know, lead with curiosity and pay attention to those moments. A Stanford professor told me that, and I have loved that ever since. So this was not mine, but I live by it. Writing fact. Okay, so I don't know if people know, but Argentina has, the name comes from Sanskrit, actually. So, Argentina comes from Arjuna. Arjuna is one of the lead characters in the Mahabharata, but his name also means silver. And Argentina, when it was being discovered, it was... Exactly. And so they named it Argentina after the way that history and culture is like kind of mixed.
Yeah.
That's where the roots come from. So Argentina and India have a little relationship.
Interesting.
Holy shit. I had no idea.
That's very cool.
Okay. First off, good pronunciation of like Argentina. Second of all, amazed. Cause yeah, like MJ, Argentina is just like full of silver mines, and they have like a whole river that's like Rio de la Plata, which is like the silver river, and it's straight up like boats with fucking silver would come down there, and that would get shipped back to the motherland. But damn, I had no idea, Aparna. That is a good fact. You nailed that.
Thank you. Yeah, I love Argentina. It's like I'm into polo. I love polo, and some of the best polo players are from Argentina. The guachos in Argentina is like, they are masters of horsemanship and riding. And they're tough guys. They're tough motherfuckers. And they're just kind of like, A round of applause to them, because if I couldn't live that life, but I will love to. Maybe one day. One day I'll there have like I'll go to Argentina and just be a guacho and just have my horses.
That would be your dream, is just like write books and ride horses and play polo.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
Beautiful. All right. Well, on that amazing imagery of just Aparna eating amazing meat and playing polo. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with MJ and I today. We really appreciate it. And for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more a month, there'll be a reading by Aparna from the Phoenix King. So go check that out. And can you let folks know that beautiful cover? Can you let folks know where they can find you on social media?
Yes. So I am spirited_gal on both Twitter and Instagram, and I'm Aparna Writes on TikTok. So you can find me there, or on my website, theapurnaverma.com, because Aparna Verma was taken, unfortunately.
Really? Oh.
So that'd be theapurnaverma.com instead of Aparna.
I like it. You pulled the Ohio State University.
Yeah. I'm here
for it. Exactly.
I gotta be the one and only, man.
Yeah.
All right. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, what about you?
You can find me pretty much everywhere at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word, and then mjkuhn.com for all the links.
And go buy Among Thieves. And
yeah, go buy Among Thieves and Thickest Thieves, please. And my cat needs dinner.
Yeah. Buy thick ass thieves.
Buy our books.
Yeah, right. Buy our books so we can feed our fur babies.
Right. Exactly.
It's all about the fur babies. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part two with Aparna to hear our mini masterclass on plot twists. Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun.
Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.